Hello and welcome to Onk Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jason Harris. Onk Live On Air is a podcast from Onk Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onk Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, I spoke with Michael J. Wagner, MD, about angiosarcoma for Onk Live's Rare Cancers series. Dr. Wagner is a physician with the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, an assistant professor with the University of Washington School of Medicine, and an assistant member at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Angiosarcoma is a rare subset of soft tissue sarcoma. Angiosarcomas make up about 2% of soft tissue sarcomas, which account for approximately 1% of all cancers in the United States. Prognosis for angiosarcoma is dismal, with a 5-year overall survival rate of just 24.3% for patients diagnosed from 2005 to 2014. For patients with metastatic disease, the 3-year OS rate is 3.8%. There is a great unmet medical need in angiosarcoma, and Dr. Wagner is optimistic that immunotherapy could be the answer. In 2021, he and his colleagues published findings from the Phase 2 DART trial evaluating ipilimumab plus nivolumab for patients with metastatic or unresectable angiosarcoma. Although only 16 patients could be evaluated for efficacy, investigators observed an overall response rate of 25%, and 2 patients had ongoing responses beyond 12 months. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Wagner talked about the struggle to investigate this rare disease, the ways research cooperatives have had recent successes in driving the science forward, and the potential for immunotherapy in this disease.
Good afternoon, Dr. Wagner. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. With angiosarcoma, how prevalent is it? I've seen that it's extremely rare, but how often are you seeing cases of angiosarcoma in your practice?
So it is extremely rare. So in the U.S., there's probably about 400 or 500 cases diagnosed per year in the whole country. But many of those patients are seen in referral sarcoma centers. So I personally see, probably about 15 or 20 patients with angiosarcoma per year. And that's probably roughly on par with a number of the other bigger sarcoma centers. So even though they're very rare, there are some oncologists who tend to treat more patients with the disease.
Typically, how does the disease present itself?
That's a good question, and there's not sort of one easy answer because it's a cancer of blood vessels. And, you know, of course, we have blood vessels all over our body. So these tumors can start really anywhere in the body. And the way they're found really does depend on where actually is it. They tend to, for whatever reason, come up in the skin very frequently. So sometimes they'll present almost like a bruise where, just as an example, so if an angiosarcoma comes up on a woman's breast where, you know, we tend to see them a little bit more frequently than some other places, it might be just originally thought to be a bruise, but then it's a bruise that doesn't go away and then eventually can just expand. And that's actually sort of what brings the patient to the doctor. Other ways they can present are just as purple spots or purple lesions on the skin. So either on the scalp is another, they're never frequent, but relatively frequent place that we'll see angiosarcomas come up. Again, they're little spots that initially, you know, might not look worrisome at all, but they just don't go away and can eventually start growing or bleeding, and that will eventually bring the patient to the doctor. If it's not in the skin, then it really does depend on where is the tumor. So sometimes people can develop pain. If it's in the lungs, people can have shortness of breath or cough. So it's something that truly can present in almost any way imaginable, which makes it a very difficult disease both to diagnose, just because it can sort of mimic itself as so many different things. And then also it's not on the forefront of most people's minds because they are so rare.
Is there any method of screening or risk assessment to possibly spot the disease early?
I think that's a good question for all cancers. And for angiosarcoma, and really honestly most sarcomas, there really isn't any sort of good effective screening method. So for angiosarcoma specifically, I think the thing to note is if there's any new spots on your skin, then especially if they're not going away and are expanding or getting worse, then that would be a reason to potentially go to the doctor. But outside of that, there's no screening for someone who's not having any symptoms or any reason to force themselves to go to the doctor. I guess the one sort of group where still I would say there's no screening that we do, but a group where I think it's important for these patients to at least be aware of the potential for developing angiosarcoma are people who have had radiation. And sort of the classic setting is someone who's had a breast-conserving therapy for breast cancer. They'll often get radiation. And then actually many years after getting the radiation, a very small fraction of those patients will develop angiosarcomas. And it's important for those patients to be aware of that because the cure rates for very early stage breast cancer are actually quite good now. And even though it's incredibly rare, there's a large number of patients who fit into that category. So if a new purple spot or a new bruise appears on their chest wall or on their breast, it's important to at least think about angiosarcoma and make sure it's not that.
You just mentioned radiation. Is that the best known risk factor, or are there other genetic factors that play into risk for developing angiosarcoma?
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting question, and it's one that we're still trying to learn a bit more about. But just in terms of what are the general risk factors for angiosarcoma, so one of the big ones is prior radiation, where a very small number of people, so really less than 1% of people who get radiation, will eventually develop an angiosarcoma. But that's a very small percentage of the people who collectively get radiation. Some other risk factors are, so historically, there are some chemical exposures that have been associated with angiosarcoma. So vinyl chloride is one. I'm honestly not 100% familiar with where that is, but I think in industrial settings, like plastics and things like that, there's potential for exposure. And then there's a compound called thorotrast with many, many years ago, so probably about 70 years ago is when that stopped being used, but it was used as a radiology contrast, I believe, in certain places in the world. And that eventually was associated with angiosarcoma. It's not widely in use, but it's at least possible that people who might have been exposed as little kids might still be alive. And we don't really truly know what's the likelihood if you're exposed to any of those agents? Arsenic's another one that potentially could cause angiosarcoma. What's the rate of angiosarcoma developing? It's such a rare cancer on average, or just as a whole, that even with exposure, the risk is probably low or very low, but a bit higher. One other risk factor that we're learning from some of the new science that is being done at a number of centers, but especially out of the Broad Institute. We've learned that UV light exposure, so just like with melanoma and other skin cancers, is probably associated with certain angiosarcomas, especially of the scalp and of the face. And we can actually now harness that information, and it's guiding some clinical trials and treatment to try and take advantage of that.
We're talking about a disease that looks like a number of other conditions. It's difficult to recognize. It's difficult to diagnose. I assume by the same token, it's also difficult to treat.
It is, for a number of reasons. So one is that unlike many other cancer types, we don't have large randomized clinical trials to truly guide our treatment for angiosarcoma. From experience and from smaller studies, we know in general what drugs work, especially chemotherapies. But again, we don't have large data sets to say this one should be used first, this other one should be used second, and then this one third. So a lot of treatment is based just on experience. And then even for patients who have localized angiosarcoma, the treatment, again, because we don't have large randomized studies, is to a large extent based on experience, but also because of the growth pattern of angiosarcoma. One way to think about it is it's a cancer of blood vessels, so it grows with a very infiltrative growth pattern. So even if a surgeon were to just remove, for example, a purple spot that you can see on the skin, if you just cut a relatively small margin around that area, I can almost guarantee you that that margin would be positive with cancer cells right up to the edge of the area that was removed. So the surgeries require actually pretty large, extensive, and sometimes very actually disfiguring surgeries in an effort to truly remove all of the cancer cells. And then we try and add on, if possible, other ways to try and truly make sure that we're killing all the cancer that we can see. And we'll often use radiation and sometimes chemotherapy as well. But even in spite of all of that, the likelihood of recurrence is unfortunately still relatively high. And especially for patients who do have recurrences or develop metastases, we're still trying to figure out what the best ways to treat it with.
When you don't have those large trials, how do you push the science forward when you're just working with, you know, small numbers of patients?
It's a challenge, to be sure, working with rare cancers and especially doing science and trying to better understand rare cancers where, you know, really any individual center only sees a handful of patients with this diagnosis a year. And I think one way, especially in angiosarcoma, where this challenge has to a certain degree been overcome is an effort that's actually based out of the Broad Institute called the Angiosarcoma Project. Now count me in, because they've expanded to a number of other cancer types, where they actually created a protocol that patients can consent for and actually submit tissue samples and clinical information that all get sent to the Broad, where they analyze it. And that effort was one of the big, I would say, groundbreaking efforts where we developed a much better understanding of the science of angiosarcoma. And sort of through that effort, that was, I would say, really the first definitive proof that it looks like there's a correlation with UV light exposure and the scalp and head and neck cancers. And that's led to actually clinical trials and a number of people using immunotherapy to treat angiosarcoma. But it's tough because that's, of course, a very large effort. And doing clinical trials, especially where, you know, you can't just have all patients go to one center, it really requires collaboration between sites and, I think, cooperative groups. So things like SWOG, Alliance, ECOG Akron, those are all really critical for doing clinical trials in, I would argue, any rare cancer, but especially with angiosarcoma.
So at this point, what is the standard of care for this disease?
That's an interesting question, because I would actually say there truly is no standard of care. There's actually a pretty wide variance of practice across even very experienced sarcoma centers and sarcoma oncologists. And you know, if I had to generalize and say truly what is the standard practice, so certainly if someone has localized disease and if it can be removed, then it should be, because the likelihood of actually curing a patient with angiosarcoma without surgery is very, very low. So if surgery can be done, then I would actually very strongly argue for it to be done. For certain patients, especially ones who are at higher risk for recurrence, I think there's more of a trend towards giving chemotherapy and then also radiation, especially for patients with localized disease. And if it's spread, then there are a number of different chemotherapies and even some targeted agents that are approved and used frequently for sarcomas in general, with some differences actually in the treatment of angiosarcoma, where they tend to actually be more responsive to taxanes, for example, especially the cutaneous angiosarcomas. There are some older, really standard chemotherapies that we use, and we're just hoping to build upon that by adding newer agents and doing some of these multi-institutional clinical trials.
What's out there then for the future? What's being investigated that you have hope could make a difference for patients at some point?
There are some trials going on even right now. I think immunotherapy is the very exciting thing in all oncology, but I would say also especially for angiosarcoma. Part of that is based on really just case reports where a number of patients were treated with immunotherapies because eventually it it's often made available to patients, even though there's not an indication necessarily on the label of the approval of the drug. But because we can access them, we have a fair bit of experience. I led a small clinical trial through SWOG called the DART study, which was a more formal way of looking at immunotherapy for use in angiosarcoma. And that showed a 25% response rate, where a quarter of the patients had their tumors shrink on the immunotherapy. And some of those patients are actually still doing very well. So that, I think, is one of the things we're most excited about, especially for angiosarcoma. There's another study that's actually enrolling right now, being run through the Alliance Cooperative Group, which is trying to move immunotherapy up in the sequencing of therapy. So it's looking at patients who already have recurrent or metastatic angiosarcoma. Will adding immunotherapy to standard chemotherapy with paclitaxel actually improve the clinical outcomes? And of course, we don't know the answer to that, but hopefully we'll get an answer in the very near future once those study results are reported. And there are some other, I think, exciting potential areas to explore for angiosarcoma, again, based on all of the sequencing work that's been done, where we and many other groups have shown that there are certain pathways that are probably relevant in helping to drive angiosarcoma tumors. So, for example, the MAP kinase pathway is one, along with the PI3K kinase mTOR pathway, where that latter one might be especially relevant actually for primary breast angiosarcomas. So again, back to one of your other questions, studying those new drugs in rare subsets of a rare cancer becomes very difficult. But I think with collaboration, and then also for lack of any other way, trying to get some of these drugs even accessed off-label, if there's a good sort of scientific rationale to do that, will give us hopefully some additional information in where should the field move forward and how can we improve outcomes for these patients.
I saw a case report with a woman who received anti-VEGF in combination with anti-PD-1, and she had a complete response after 6 cycles. But with only one patient, can you draw any conclusions from that case report?
So that's an interesting case for sure. Can we draw any true conclusions? I would say no, other than that that's very encouraging that she had such a good response. And that sort of is consistent with what we're seeing with immunotherapies in a number of different patients with angiosarcoma, both as case reports and also now on clinical trials. You mentioned that she was also treated with a VEGF inhibitor. So in the not too distant past, we were very excited about VEGF inhibitors because intuitively it would make sense that you would treat a cancer of the blood vessels with the main growth factor, or one of the main growth factors that really drives blood vessel development. They haven't been as successful as we would have hoped, but there are some patients whose tumors are at least in part driven by alterations in that VEGF pathway. So there are certain mutations in the VEGF receptor that we know can be very sensitive to some of the drugs that inhibit that receptor. And then there are also cases of patients actually with more copies of some of those genes. And I know of at least one published case report that showed a patient who had a really good response to pazopanib, so a drug that inhibits the VEGF receptor. So for this particular patient, I don't know the molecular changes she might have, but either one of those drugs actually has the potential to be very effective. And you know, it's very encouraging that this patient did so well. Without knowing more, it's hard to say, you know, which one of those was more active. And it's also possible, actually, just extrapolating from other science and especially other cancers, that the combination might actually make a difference, where sometimes by giving a VEGF inhibitor, that might change the immune microenvironment of the cancer that then sort of helps facilitate the immunotherapy and the immune cells to do what we want them to do. So with just one patient, that I can't really draw many conclusions other than to say that it's very exciting that, you know, that patient's having a good response. And I think it would be great if there were biopsy samples or sequencing samples to really understand the science of that patient's tumor to try and figure out, well, why is she having such a great response to these drugs?
The science has largely been moving away from treating cancers by site of origin and more towards the molecular characteristics. So has science been able to identify the molecular drivers of angiosarcoma?
So we do know some, again, largely based out of that big sequencing effort from the Broad. But even before that, we were starting to get a sense for what helps drive angiosarcomas, where really one of the first distinctions that was made was primary angiosarcomas, the ones that just come up seemingly out of nowhere, versus secondary angiosarcomas, which are the ones that come up in people who have had prior radiation or in the setting of chronic lymphedema. And molecularly, they're actually distinct, where the secondary angiosarcomas tend to have MYC amplification. So that's, of course, common in a number of different cancer types, and it's very hard to target with a drug. But that's one difference between the two groups, where secondary angiosarcomas are driven by MYC amplification and, to a lesser extent, amplification of one of the other VEGF receptors. Through the sequencing effort, some other probable drivers have been identified. So there's a relatively small number of people who actually have mutations in the VEGF receptor that actually drives the tumor. A few other mutations have been identified. So there was some work out of MD Anderson a number of years ago that identified some common alterations. So specifically, one of the genes is PLCG1, which is also involved in VEGF signaling, where there's actually a recurring mutation in a small subset of patients with angiosarcoma, but that really does seem to be a driver mutation. In patients with primary breast angiosarcoma, they can have PIK3CA mutations, which, you know, at least we think could be a driver mutation, although we still have a little bit more work to do to really prove that. And not necessarily a driver mutation, but for the face and scalp angiosarcomas especially, it looks like they tend to have a pattern of DNA damage that's consistent with prior UV light exposure and just UV damage, so similar to other skin cancers. But because of that, they just have a high mutation burden, which presumably helps drive that cancer growth, but also serves as a treatment target with immunotherapies.
Do you feel, I guess, optimistic about where angiosarcoma research is headed right now?
I do. I think just because the science for this rare cancer is actually so well developed, it opens up opportunities to have smartly designed clinical trials. So both with immunotherapies and other targeted agents. I think the big challenge is, just because it's so rare, actually doing a large clinical trial has many burdens associated with it, or just difficulties or hurdles that need to be overcome. But the science driving some of the clinical trials that are being proposed and in some cases currently being done in angiosarcoma is really excellent. And even since I started my fellowship not too long ago, I would say the treatment of angiosarcoma has been improved. And that's especially with the introduction of immunotherapies and newer clinical trials. And I think the future is looking bright. We, again, still have a lot of work to do, but we certainly have more treatment options today than we did just, say, 10 years ago.
Thanks again for taking the time out to speak with us this afternoon. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks again to my guest, Dr. Michael J. Wagner, and thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.